Radio Store. My name is Sam Mulberry. Today we are talking about the 2003 film Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter, and Spring. So let's step into Barrett Fisher's Video Store. Barrett, how you doing?
Doing great, Sam.
Barrett, I'm going to actually wait to ask you my typical starting question because I want to ask you a different question. This is our 177th movie. So at this point, you know a little bit about me as a movie watcher. What do you think I thought of this movie? I'd never heard of it. Didn't know anything about it. What do you think I thought of this movie?
I think you loved it.
I loved it. This is, how can we be this late into the podcast and you casually toss off something that's like, maybe this is going to be one of your favorite movies of all time? Like I am overcome by how much I loved this movie. And I want to say that up top, cause we're going to get into a lot of things with this movie and this director, but man, was this great. So I'm so excited to talk about this. What is your history with this film? Is this something you were aware of when it came out? How did you come across this?
Yeah, you know, I was trying to figure out, as I often do, Sam, I can pinpoint when I first kind of dug into the film a little bit. I used it in fairly early in the 2009 iteration of my film theory class. But I honestly don't remember how I came up with it. I certainly hadn't seen it when it came out in the theater. I'm quite sure of that. And even looking at my class notes, I'm not exactly sure why I picked the film at that point in the class. It was a point in the course when we were talking about, and this is a topic you and I have talked about frequently, we talked about what is unique to the film medium. What can film do that other media can't do? And then I was looking again at my class notes, and I actually had, we looked at two different scenes to kind of contrast what was going on. One scene where there were 33 shots that had a duration of 5.6 seconds, another scene where there were 48 shots that had a duration of 8.2 seconds, and just kind of talked about the similarities and differences between those scenes. So I guess I was trying to get students to think a little bit about how the film medium worked, but why I picked this particular film, I honestly don't remember.
Wow. That's so interesting. Now I'm, cause like, it's funny. I often will watch things with kind of a formal eye that way. And I didn't like, I now I'm curious, like what scenes were they that had, you know, those shots and things, you know, that succession of shots and things like that. Have you seen other films from Kim Ki-duk?
No. And, I understand, at least up to the point that this film was made, that this was not a typical film. For this director. He was known, I guess, for kind of action and violence. And even he was described by one person as a misogynistic director.
Well, it's interesting because like all I know of him is looking at the, you know, when you do a Google search for him and you see, oh, here's his movie posters. And it's exactly that. I look at the posters and I'm like, this movie doesn't seem to fit into those other things.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, he appears in the film he's the oldest version of the monk towards the end. But no, I've been wanting to kind of track him down and see what he's been up to since this film, but I have not done that.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about him because I loved this film so much. It made me want to read a little bit about him, and he has his darkness and demons. And normally we don't get into this. I want to say some of these things because I think they're relevant to what this movie's about. And also, if I'm going to full-throatedly talk about how much I love this movie, I want to acknowledge some other things about the author and filmmaker. So we'll do this up top, and then we'll move on to talk about the film. But I do think, in some ways, they touch on things this film talks about and color some of the things in this film. Let's see where to start. In 2000, so this would have been before this, his film The Isle was delayed by the release of it was delayed by the British Board of Film Classification because of instances of animal cruelty in the film. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting thinking about this film, and I mean, this is 3 years later, what this film has to say. I mean, his defense of this was, you know, to a certain degree, like we eat meat and we, you know, like we don't want to think about those things, you know, that are part of that process. And then this movie itself talks about that. And this movie has its own controversy around this, famously the, final, sort of mini chapter to this movie, The End Spring, has a scene that was cut out of international release where, I mean, this movie depicts animal cruelty, but it's even more graphic in the final chapter. That the other thing that I want to say about him is that in 2017 and 18, he was accused by at least three actresses of physical assault, verbal and physical harassment, and rape. And I bring that up in part because this movie deals with human violence, and a particularly violence against women. Mm-hmm. And so I want to say those things. He denied those allegations. He died of COVID-19 in 2020. So in some ways, like, those, as those stories were coming out and kind of being investigated, like, he dies, and then like they kind of don't come to anything after that. So he's not working on anything now, that is to say.
So yeah, if he were to produce something, it would be pretty extraordinary.
Yes.
So I mean that's really interesting, Sam, because it brings up another kind of related issue. As you said, this is normally not an area we talk about, but there are certain filmmakers where their biography seems so entangled with their films that they're hard not to think about. So you think about people, maybe most notoriously, I would imagine, Woody Allen and Roman Polanski, mm-hmm. where it's hard to know what to do with their body of work when you know about the work of their body, so to speak. So I think I think it's a good reminder that as we've talked about the auteur theory, that I think we have to be careful to think about, what do we mean by the auteur? Do we mean the actual real person, or do we mean the embodiment of that person as the author of the film? And, you know, I mean, I think that we would love to see a continuity between a person's work and their life and their work, but people are more complex than that, right? And yeah, maybe this film was a way for him to kind of confront some of those inner demons, because he is actually the monk, you know, carrying that mm-hmm. stone up the mountain at the end. But you know, people do their best, and sometimes they fail.
Right, and I mean, again, I think that's a theme in this movie, and it's interesting. It's not like this was the last thing that he made, so it's like, this is not about him coming to terms with these things. This is about there's the incongruity of how can somebody make this statement and do this thing, but then we're getting into a conversation about humanity and human nature and sin, which are all interesting questions, but are maybe beyond the scope of what we're talking about here. But I wanted to say those things up top as we get into this, because there are going to be moments where we might not bring it back up, but events in the film might make you say, oh, okay, that's interesting to think about in light of who this person is.
I think one final thought about this, Sam. I also think that our perspective is always influenced by romanticism. The romantic view of the artist sees a continuity between the artist's existence as an individual and his or her expression as an artist. And in some senses, the essence of romanticism is really lyricism. That is, art as self-expression. But if you look before the romantic movement, the way the artists were thought of as artisans. Mm-hmm. So if somebody makes a beautiful chair, do I assume that that person has a beautiful soul? Or do I assume that that person is a virtuous person just because he or she has made a beautiful object? But romanticism's kind of ruined that for us in a sense. And so we see the art now as kind of the outpouring or the expression of the soul. And therefore, if it's a beautiful piece of art, or even in terms of the reception of art, if somebody can receive art and appreciate art, we therefore assume there's a kind of an ethical quality to either the art or the person receiving it. And I'm not sure that's always the case. You know, I mean, I think that we have the capacity to appreciate and create beauty, and at the same time to be cruel and unkind.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, this movie feels like an expression of the soul. That's, yes. That's the hard part, is like, I buy that with a chair, because a chair may not feel like it has to be an expression of the soul. This movie feels so much like that. But again, I just wanted to say those things because, and I wanted to say it because, as we started out, I also need to say, like, this movie was designed in a lab for me. This is, I was talking with a friend of mine, Annie Berglund, who's on another show on the network, who lives in South Korea. And I was saying, oh, have you ever heard of this film? And I said, you should watch this. And I started to describe it. And she said, oh, so this is your favorite movie. And I'm like, kind of, this is the kind of thing I like, because it's slow and contemplative, and it's literally monastic. Like, these are things that I love. I think it's interested in big questions about human nature and life and religion, and it's interested in time. This is another thing. It's why I like Some of the projects Richard Linklater is doing. It's why I like Christopher Nolan is interested in time. This film is also interested in thinking about time, and you know, or Gene Dielman's thinks about time. Like that's the kind of thing I'm fascinated by, and this movie's very much into that. Both time in terms of a human's lifetime, but then also time blown out to a universal scale of thinking about time, and thinking about time in ways that I probably don't think about it, because this is thinking cyclically about time as well.
Yeah, even though I kind of dislike the title because it's always so hard to remember, although once you remember that begins with spring, you're okay. But I kind of see why he had to go with that title. And I wondered if it's, I wonder, I don't have any evidence of this. I wonder if the title was any different in Korean. But I mean, I suppose, you know, he could have named it something having it here. He could have called it Karma, I suppose, and that might have achieved the same goal. But I do think there is that certainly the title expresses that notion of time as cyclical, but at the same time, the possibility of change and yet the possibility of stasis, which you kind of get with both characters at the end.
So you just nailed one of the things that I want to think about, which is, before we get into the specifics of this, it's hard to describe this movie without really just telling some of the story. So we're going to get into things that happen in this movie. But I was trying to think of adjectives I would use to describe this movie, and there's such an incongruity even in that, because at one level, it's like, there is a kind of sweetness to this movie, especially when I think about the older monk and his responses to things, where I think his response is going to be one thing and it's something else. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a kind of grace and inspiration to this. This kind of has a story about a redemption. At the same time, this is a movie about cruelty and violence, death. It's very bleak if you want to read it that way too. And then I have like neutral terms too, like time, work, repetition, cycles. Mm-hmm. It's like all of those things are true, which makes me feel like, oh, well, that makes it feel like life then, right? Because it is both of those things. I was talking with my wife about it, and my first sentence out of my mouth was like, do you want to watch this really sweet movie? And then I stopped myself and said, well, it's actually not that, but it is, but it's like, the second I say it's one thing, I need to contradict myself and say, actually, it's the other.
It's a charming existential meditation.
That's right. That's absolutely right. The other thing I loved about this movie is that it seems so laden with symbols and symbolism. Mm-hmm. But as a Westerner who is, you know, kind of only steeped in Western symbolism, stories, philosophies, Judeo-Christian religion, so much of the symbolism feels beyond my grasp. Like, mm-hmm. I can tell, oh, this means something, but at the same time, I feel like there's a distance between me and the meaning. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's odd. You can point to a symbol, but then say, but I don't know what it means, but I know that has to mean something. And in that way, it reminds me of watching, this might be a weird comparison, of watching Spirited Away or other Miyazaki movies, where there is just this sense of like, I don't know if what I'm seeing is coming from Korean culture, from Buddhist culture, or if it's an invention of the filmmaker and they're just creating a symbol. I don't have access to that, but there is something really powerful about that.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point, Sam. Right. So, you know, we're good enough viewers that we know something important is happening, but we're not always sure how to nail it down. And of course, what we don't know is that maybe even an insider of that culture wouldn't be sure whether or not he's using the symbol traditionally or with his own particular kind of twist on it. So I did look up some of the symbols, but I have no idea.
So did I.
I have no idea if the information I got was actually accurate. And some of it I really can't quite square with what's going on in the film, because filmmakers are like any artist, always have the option of personalizing the symbols in ways that maybe other people don't necessarily read them.
And because it's almost in a weird way, it's almost like the way people read The Shining or something, because it's like, it also feels like everything's a symbol, and it's like, maybe this thing's just a tree, maybe it's not a symbol, maybe, you know, because like I think, man, we could have a full hour conversation about that boat and all the things that boat is in this movie. Yes. Like, how interesting is that? But then there's animals, and then there's this, and there, so one example of the thing like being beyond my grasp, it's one of the most arresting images in this movie, and it comes from the winter section when the mother comes with the child and she has the scarf over her face.
Yeah.
It's such an arresting image. And it's like, I don't know what to make of this. It feels like the movie has rules, maybe, but it doesn't explain those rules. And then I'm not sure if there even are, like, is that a thing? I kept writing in my notes, like, is this a thing that somebody sees and is like, oh, this comes from this? Or is it just, we get it? Like, I get the face covered. I understand it, but I don't know why.
Right. Well, I guess I see a couple of things going on with the face covering. I mean, obviously it's an expression of shame and you know, and not wanting to identify yourself. We assume the child is a child out of wedlock or a child out of adultery. But I think, to me, within the logic of the film, I think the covering of her face connects with the two, with him and his master covering their faces with soot. You know, and the purpose of doing that is to block off the senses, because the senses are what has led you into whatever this particular sin that you're committing or that you feel tempted to commit may be. Although I think when the older monk does it at the end, it's more of a farewell to the life of the senses. When the young monk does it early on, it's because he's trying to conquer the senses. So to me, whether or not, you know, I have a suspicion that it's not a thing in Korean society for adulterous women or women ashamed to go around with their heads covered like that. But that's just my guess. But to me, within the logic of the film, the important thing is that these are three people all struggling against the senses, trying to find some kind of relief or transcendence.
Right. And what I love about it is it doesn't matter. Like, like with Miyazaki, it's not like you're uncracking a code. It's like, oh, I get it. It's like, that's really interesting. And again, I will never forget that image, especially of watching her cry through the scarf. And it's like, this is one of the most powerful images I've ever seen. And it's so strange and disturbing in a kind of way, you know, and it's just like, I love it. And you don't need to understand it, but it's definitely sitting there.
But it also allows the filmmaker to do something very tantalizing, right? Mm-hmm. Because when he uncovers the face, we don't know who it is.
Right. We get this really long shot.
We can guess, but we don't know for sure. So she's both kind of any woman and she could be a specific woman.
Exactly.
But he's not going to answer it for us.
Exactly. So this film, we should say, is broken into four 25-minute chapters plus one 5-minute mini chapter to imply the circularity of this. And what I love about this, and this is where I was saying, like, it's about both the life of a specific person, but also this sort of universal thing, is especially the first three chapters, and I'm starting to convince myself of four as well, like, could stand alone as short films, could just be like, you could just see that and say, like, think about Spring. It's like, yeah, that is sufficient in a way. It reminds me, when I was in college, I got really into reading the writings and stories from and about desert fathers and mothers. And they would be these little parable kind of stories. And you get the same thing in South Asian and East Asian, you know, stories of monks and wise people. So it sort of feels like that, like it could be these individual pieces, but at the same time, the movie's not asking you to watch it that way. It is saying this, you're watching the life of this, these people, these specific people, which is why it's important that at least the older actor remain the same person. So you get this continuity of that person and of the space, and you get these markers of time. So it feels both like these are individual things, but also these individual things fit together to tell you something else. I find it interesting to think, like, this is a movie that starts in spring, but I spent a lot of time, maybe too much time, thinking about this movie, and I realized, like, you could start this movie in any season and have it go through the cycle and then have whatever its necessary and, you know, partial season, and the movie works. The story is basically the same. The tone might shift a little bit if you end with, you know, if you start with the death and then there's this sense, like the suicide death, and then there's this sense that the suicide death is coming again. But this movie implies this whole cycle is going to keep happening. I don't know that I've ever seen a movie like that where you could say you could actually just shift all of the chapters and it's like it is still the same story. So I did all these, I charted out, there's four iterations of this movie you could do. The most linear is not the one that he chooses. The most linear would be to start with the baby coming and then end with a new baby coming, because then you would basically track this guy from being a baby all the way up through being an adult, and then in the final chapter he is kind of the holy man now. like you would get that sense, and that to me is a little bit more linear. This order shows me that this movie is really about the student teacher relationship. This is structured, this choice is the one which structures around because the truth is the baby's not being taught by the master, but when he's a boy we get the beginnings of that, and then we get through the ends of that, and that crossover. But I just thought that was kind of fascinating to work through. At the same time, it makes sense to start with Spring. I have to say, I guess maybe I'll ask you this question, because I went into this with, you know, kind of vague cultural senses of what Buddhism is, but I don't know a lot about Buddhism. Do you know a lot about Buddhism?
No, I don't know a lot about Buddhism. Okay. I probably know a few basics of Buddhism. And that's
okay. So we should go into this acknowledging, yes. like I think this movie is fascinating to think about. Like, you know how sometimes you'll watch a movie and be like, yeah, the Christ imagery is a little heavy handed. I wonder if to a Buddhist, if they would watch this and say, yeah, like this is kind of it on its face. Cause the more I read about things, I'm like, oh, I actually feel like I know exactly what this structure is now, as I was reading more, not about the movie, but trying to figure out, like, hey, what do I need to know about Buddhism? All of a sudden, I'm like, I found the thing when I was reading the Four Noble Truths, and I'm like, oh, that's the structure of this movie. Each chapter is one of the Four Noble Truths, and that's why the order matters. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to figure, like, what's the theme of this? And I was writing down to myself, like, well, here's what I think the theme of this story is. And then I went and read the Four Noble Truths, and I was like, oh, it's actually, I think if you know this, it's very obvious in that way. Although I didn't see anybody write about that specifically.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, well, I did, back when I taught the film, I did talk with a fellow faculty member who is an expert on Buddhism, Jim Lewis. And he's the one that told me how to make sense of shut, it's closing the gateway of the senses. And then he said, when he's praying before the altar, he might be making a vow, or he might be asking the Buddha to help him. In Mahayana Buddhism, and of course I know there's different Buddhist sects, and I know nothing about their distinctives, but Jim told me that in Mahayana Buddhism, unlike other traditions, the Buddha may actually provide help. So that could tell you, but again, it's ambiguous. So he could just be making a vow, or he could be asking for help. So that was a little bit of quote expert knowledge that I got at the time.
All right, well, let's get into these stories. So we start with Spring, and we get the first symbol of this movie, which are these gates opening up.
Yes.
And this movie's full of gates and doors that serve as symbols, and literally not as gates and doors, because they don't keep anything in or out.
Right.
When we get into the house and we realize the door, it's one room and there are two doors in it, but the doors don't block anything. But what's interesting is they're respected. It's right. Respected that if you're going to go into the bedroom, you're going to go through the door, even though there's no actual reason to do that. And that's one of those moments where early on in the movie where I'm like, okay, we're up to something here. Interesting. And, and then you see them use the door a couple times and you're like, okay, I'm going to wait for somebody to transgress this, because that's going to happen. You're going to see. And of course it does happen, in summer, you see the first time somebody doesn't go through those doors.
Yeah. They're obviously, they define liminal spaces, and they work almost like spiritual portals. I don't know exactly how Buddhism thinks about, I know how Buddhism thinks about the spiritual world and the natural world. In some ways there's continuity between the two, but in other ways there's differences marked between the two. And so when they take the boat, obviously, to the shore, those doors open to kind of symbolize that now they are in a kind of a different world, not only physically, but maybe spiritually at the same time. And even the fact that, doors open up, but then you still have to go across the water to get to the floating hermitage. So.
Well, what's interesting is the respect for those gates, that people will, to get to the house, people will go through those gates, even if it means walking through water to get to them to walk through it. even though then they're going to call for somebody to come over in a boat. Instead of standing on the shore and saying, can you bring the boat here? There is this sense of you go through these gates, you stand in the ankle to knee deep water and wait for the boat to come to you, that there is this kind of respect for those rules or customs.
And it does have a connection with, you know, especially the Old Testament practices in the Bible, right? You have ways of marking sacred spaces. You have ways of distinguishing between holy and profane. And you have ways of kind of reminding yourself to be in a particular frame of mind as a result of entering a particular space. And it brings a consciousness about what you are doing that you might not otherwise have.
Absolutely. So then we get the introduction of this house. I mean, this is maybe the great setting of a movie ever. Like, it's, and I think they found a park and built this, but I assume that there are examples of things like this house on a raft in the middle of a lake, which is in a valley surrounded by mountain. It's like the most remote thing you could be at. So it's remarkable to look at. And I love, at first I thought, is this a tiny little island that they built a deck around? But you realize as the movie goes on that house is moving.
Yeah,
it's moving, and so you creates these amazing shots where whenever you're getting a shot of somebody on the deck outside, if you pay attention, the background is slightly moving. So there is this sense of like stability and flux. And then and sometimes they emphasize that with time lapse. You know, so they'll there's a couple moments where they'll do that to speed up this change, and that's later in the movie, but at first you have to pick it up in really small ways. So what would you say the main theme of this first chapter is?
Oh gosh, I think the main theme I would say is, I don't know if I want to say a fall from innocence, or I want to say the realization of sin, or you know, so I mean the key line, right, is when he tells the boy, you know, if any of those animals are dead, you will carry the stone in your heart for the rest of your life. So maybe it's almost the unavoidability of karma, you know, mm-hmm. that you are going to do something because this is just what people do, but it's going to create for you a burden that you're going to have to deal with the rest of your life. So I think it's like it's a great refutation of the essential innocence of the child. So if you think about it that way, so earlier I referenced romanticism. So it's certainly a counter thrust to a romantic view of children.
Absolutely, no, I love that idea of like the introduction of sin. So like in a Christian sense, it's like this is the fall, right? And if we're going to the first noble truth. And this lines up perfectly with what you just said. The first noble truth is that suffering is an innate characteristic of the perpetual cycle of grasping for things, ideas, and habits, mm-hmm. right? So there is this sense of like, this is when he learns about suffering. And yes. He, you know, like that is established. And that is the first teaching of Buddhism. So we, in this chapter, we see the boy, and it's just a great performance by this kid. We see him, you know, first going out in with the master to the, you know, to the mountains around them, and he's going to collect herbs, and he's warned about dangers, right? He says, be aware of snakes. Mm-hmm. And then when he takes the herbs and they go back, the master's teaching him like some of these things are medicine and some of these things will kill you.
Yep.
Right. So there is this sense that like there is danger and suffering. And then we see the boy go out on his own and plays. This is the first time we see him alone in the boat. But when he's going with the master the first time, you watch him mimic the master, like he's trying to learn how to row the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see him go out on his own. He's very much struggling to do that. But he goes out on his own and he starts to interact with the animals. He tries to catch butterflies and can't do that. But then he tries to catch fish with his hands and he does. And we see him tie a rock around a fish, tie a rock around a frog, tie a rock around a snake. And we see the master behind him up on the rocks looking at him, which is one of those moments where the master is perfectly dry, so you're like, how did he get there? There's one boat and the boat's been taken, so that there's this kind of mystery. And we see later in the movie the master seems to have some sort of power over that boat and over the lake.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's the first thing you say to yourself, wait, how did the master get there? And right, and then later on we see And often, you know, associated with those monks are some sorts of almost supernatural powers. And so whether he can bilocate or levitate or whatever, there's a suggestion that he's got, yeah, that he has power. So one of the things the boy is learning, of course, is that you can't cause suffering without suffering yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really the introduction to that notion that what you do is you're ultimately going to have to reckon with it one way or the other. But at the same time, you know, you don't see that the boy has evil intentions, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he laughs while he's doing this because he thinks it's just kind of fun, and he doesn't know he's causing suffering. He just thinks he's amusing himself, and so he has to discover that as well. That just because something seems pleasurable, I mean, what the master says about the herbs is relevant, right? He says deadly and healthy look the same, and in a sense, that's what the boy has to learn.
Right, I mean, because part of it is he's learning that he has power. But what it means to assert power is to potentially cause suffering, you know, because he is asserting his power over those animals. So then the monk ties the stone around the little boy while he's sleeping. And then, you know, it says you have to go free them. And if any of them are dead, you'll carry this with you. And he goes and the fish is dead. And interestingly, the frog is still alive. Then the snake is dead. So I did a little bit of, there's lots of animals in this movie. So I did a little bit of reading about animals. Fish are again, all this could be totally wrong. Fish are symbolic of migrating fearlessly from place to place freely and spontaneously. Snakes are both guardians. They're often guardians of the Buddha. You'll see snakes around them, but they also symbolize death and rebirth and mortality. The snakes shedding its skin, which hold on to that because we see the snake later, definitely symbolizes that. And the frog symbolizes wisdom and patience. And there is this sense that the frog, from the second he puts the rock on it, just keeps trying, keeps doing the same thing, trying and trying. So when he goes and finds it later, it's in the same spot, trying to go up to that spot. And then once he unties it, the frog goes back to that same spot, but now can accomplish what he was trying to do.
Well, as long as we're doing animals, I will mention, is this is important as well. The rooster is a symbol of desire and craving, according mm-hmm. to Wandering. So that's going to become very important.
Right. And the rooster is the pet in the second chapter. The pet in the first chapter is a dog.
I read
viewed as a lowly creature, but it symbolizes a new student because the dogs will ingest almost everything around them. Okay. So the dog is symbolic of a new student, which fits perfectly with this young student who's taking in the world and the good and the bad of it. So we end with this boy coming to the realization that he has brought suffering to the world, and the realization of that stone that he carries with him. Mm-hmm. He's crying, and we at the end of that chapter.
And the other kind of key word in this chapter, which comes up again in summer, is heart. Mm-hmm. The master says it's the stone in your heart, and then heart becomes very important as he talks to him about preparing herbs later on and his relationship with the young girl.
Mm-hmm. So then, as we move to summer, we see the gates open again, and now we see the boy is a teenager. He sees what I think are snakes mating.
Yeah.
There's like a ball. So I think that's how snakes mate, which is like heavy symbolism. Like I saw that and thought, I think I know where this chapter's going from that first thing. We see the mother bringing the sick daughter. And this is the first time we see the outside world.
Yeah. And the first indication, this is a contemporary story, mm-hmm. right? Because up to now we could be in the 17th or 16th century for all we know. Yeah, so it's kind of funny the way they just show up in these modern clothes, and you realize that you're looking at it. Kind of emphasizes the ancient nature of the religious tradition that you're seeing, almost the timeless nature of it, even though it's within the wheel of time.
Well, and what's interesting is these two and the other outside characters we're going to get later hold the master in great reverence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he, like, what he says matters to them. They're going to this place for specific reasons. So even though they are part of a modern world, modern technologies, all these things, they look to him for as the source of a kind of wisdom. So here we get the introduction of the rooster as the new pet. And then we always see the rooster eating, you know, so we're thinking about desire, right? The rooster's always is appetitive in that way. The master's always feeding the rooster. The rooster's always eating.
Mm-hmm.
Now this story, as we know, you know, ends up being about, these two eventually falling in love and then the master having to deal with that. So the second noble truth is about, suffering arising simultaneously with desire or attachment,
mm-hmm.
which is exactly what this is about, yes. Right? Like that is so this is where I feel like, what, again, would a Buddhist be like, it's kind of heavy handed with like with the symbolism here. So, I love the first image that we see of the boy really interacting with the girl after the mother leaves. She's sitting on the deck and it's raining and she's looking out at the boat and he comes over with the basket and just holds it over her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wordless scene, but it is this like introduction of a like courting ritual, right? You know, like I'm thinking about the snakes again, like what are the mating rituals, courting rituals, you know, that he is showing this kind of care for her. And here's where we start to see the boy transgress in this chapter, right? We see him in two ways. There's two kinds of transgressions. We see him twice go around the door to get by the sleeping master so he can get to the girl.
Mm-hmm.
We also see him cross lines with her twice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where, so
mm-hmm.
when she's falls asleep praying and he comes and covers her up, and then mm-hmm. he basically gropes her, right? And she wakes up and she hits him. And then he does it again later when they're at the, on the shore.
Yeah.
And you know, she's trying to pick up fish and he, you know, gives her a fish and then essentially touches her breast again and she pushes him down, right? So there is this sense that he is pushing now at lines, and transgressing some of the understood or should be understood rules that he's up against.
What's interesting is you think about what happens in this chapter, Sam, is that she's come for some kind of healing, and the master says she needs peace in her soul, then her body will recover. So it's an interesting exchange if you think about it, right? That she and the boy, the teenager, engage in the same activity. And yet it seems that for her, this seems to be part, I mean, I don't know if it's actually part of an actual healing or if the master just realizes he needs to find a way to send her away. But evidently she has experienced some kind of recovery. It's as though for her, what's happened is a kind of love has been awakened. And for the boy, it's more a kind of lust has been awakened.
Exactly.
And the emphasis on, you know, the master says, lust awakens the desire to possess, and that awakens the intent to murder. Well, that's the equivalent of a Chekhov gun in the first act. Once he says that, you know what's going to happen. So it's interesting because what it suggests is that the same activity doesn't mean the same thing to every person. So when he finds out what they've been doing, in that wonderful scene where he discovers them in the boat, uses the rooster, right, to reel them in. Not his magical powers. That's interesting. He doesn't bring the boat to himself magically. He uses the rooster. And then his whole response is, that happens by itself. It is just nature. Mm-hmm. So evidently for the girl, it's just nature. But for the boy, it is this desire to possess and to own.
Right. I mean, that's what I loved about that is that I was expecting him to be upset about one thing.
Yeah.
He's not upset that they had sex. He says, you know, then if she's better, then that was the right medicine. Like, right. Who are we to question that? But I know what's happening, and what's happening is desire. What's happening is the desire to possess, and that becomes a problem. Another thing that this chapter introduces that becomes a theme is a location that I didn't know was going to be an important location, which is the same place where the fish and the frog and the snake are, the rock is tied around them.
Yeah.
That is where they have sex for the first time.
That's
too.
Right. Yep.
And we keep coming back to that location.
Yep.
In the same way, the boat, now we see the boat used as, you know, he's like showing off in the boat, like doing the one-handed paddling in the circle. Like the boat is now something he uses for courtship. It's something, it's a place where they make love, right? So there is this, like, again, I'm interested in the utility of the boat and how it changes by the seasons as well.
Well, also, I think not only the boat, but the boat, I mean, it's so obvious, of course, but the water, because you have the water at different levels depending on the season. You have the water that's frozen. You have the waterfall that's a frozen waterfall and the ice carving. So, you know, water is kind of the natural element that corresponds. I mean, that's the way you mark the seasons, really, is how H2O changes depending on the time of year.
Absolutely. So then the monk sends the girl away, takes her away, and then we see the teen boy restless at night. He gets up. Again, I think I don't remember if he goes through the door or not at this point, or if he goes around it, but he takes the Buddha statue, puts it in his backpack. He also takes the rooster. So yes. He takes both the physical Buddha and desire and gets in the boat to follow her. And what's interesting is the master wakes up to that, lets him, doesn't stop him, sits and prays to like the empty spot where the Buddha should be. Mm-hmm. So I also see this as something about possession too. He's like, it's not about the physical thing, you know, like that's not the thing, but even you're even taking your religion and making it something about possession as well, right? I'm going to take this thing with me. And it's weird because the rooster doesn't make any sense for him to take, except for symbolically, it makes sense.
Well, maybe it's a guarantee he has a meal on the road.
But then we see the rooster the end of this chapter is the rooster just walking out in the woods by itself.
I think it's a perfect symbol of somebody who it's, you know, I want to repent, but I really can't repent yet. Right. Mm-hmm. So he's got both things with him.
Yes. Yes. No, I mean, it's Augustine talking to me, you know, exactly. Wanting to be freed from his sin, but not yet.
But not yet. Yes. Yeah. Yes, give me, yes. Lord, give me chastity, but not yet.
So then we move to fall. Again, we have the gates open. Now we see the master is coming, presumably from town, is returning to the house. He has, interestingly, a cat with him, and the cat is in his backpack in the same way the Buddha is in the backpack of the boy, like the head is sticking out.
Yes.
And later we see the cat sit at the spot where the Buddha sits.
Yep.
You know, as he's praying. So there is this like kind of, you know, replacement cats are viewed as like these, I mean, again, they're like a holy creature known for watchfulness and mindfulness, you know, because they protect food stores and things like that. We see the monk start to eat, and then he reads, and you know, this story about the boy. So now we know how much time has passed, right? It's the story. He's 30 years old, and he has killed his wife. So like you said, when the word murder is brought up in the second chapter, it's like this is the payoff to that. We're like, okay, this has now happened. So we get this sense that the boy's going to return. And he returns, and they have what is, I think, the longest conversation in the film, which is basically three lines. The monk sits down and says, tell me something interesting about your life. The world of man has grown agonizing for you, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And the man says, my only sin was to love. I wanted nothing except her. She went with another man. He says, didn't you know what the world of men was like beforehand? Sometimes you have to let go of things we like. What you like, others will also like.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads to the third noble truth, which is suffering can be ended by letting go of desire. Right. And that's what this one's about, is like,
yes.
How do you learn to let go of those things that are causing suffering? Right? Like the things you desire, to possess, is the root of suffering. And this chapter is all about how do we start to reckon with that?
Yeah. And it's about, in that sense, it's about control. It's about the idea that you don't have to be controlled by your emotions. You don't have to be controlled by your desires. They are inevitable, but you have a choice as to how you act on them. And if you reverse that, you sense that I am in control of not being in their control. You actually can figure that out. But it's interesting how he has to kind of, one of the things I love about this section, Sam, is the way he really has to, you watch him literally working, you know, working this out. Mm-hmm. And at one point, The monk says something to him like, "You can kill easily, but you cannot be easily killed."
Yes.
You know, the master beats him when he puts the shut on his face. The master beats him like that's ridiculous. And then you see him, you know, suspended from that rope. And the candle that's burning through the rope is the same candle the mm-hmm. master uses at the end, right, to kill himself. So it's you know, and then he cuts his hair with the murder weapon, right? So it's just this wonderful series of kind of symbolic actions. It's very difficult to show a person repenting or working through their sin, but I think he manages to do this by all these exterior actions that tell you what's going on internally.
Well, there's another to go back to symbols we've talked about. Now, when he goes out in the boat, he's violently thrashing at the water with the paddles, right? So it's as if he's not even trying to get anywhere. He's just trying to work out. And then he goes to the same place where he had tortured the animals, where he had sex with the girl for the first time. And now he's just in the water thrashing. It's just like his, you know, so again, we keep returning to these locations and they're another kind of meaning, another, you know, we're seeing another thing being worked out. So it's interesting that the master stops the boy and, you know, gives him that line of, you know, that you said of, you can so easily kill, but you cannot be easily killed. And it's from there, that's where the boy starts to cut his hair. And then the master starts to paint the Heart Sutra mm-hmm. On the deck. So again, going back to the heart, mm-hmm. right? If the heart is a theme here, that is the Heart Sutra, which I did a little bit of reading on this. This is sort of beyond me, but it's basically talking about how all phenomena we experience is emptiness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that makes sense out of the, like, shutting off the senses at the end of this to say, like, all of those things of our senses are pathways to kinds of to emptiness, right? Mm-hmm. Pathways to desire, pathways to suffering, pathways to emptiness. And then we get this great thing where when the boy comes out and he tells him to start cutting out the characters, and he just keeps writing, and you're like, how long is this going to go on for? And then the police come, and I love the police are two of my favorite characters in this, because again, there are these modern figures. I mean, one has a cell phone, they're modern clothes, guns, things like this. They're like from a different movie, and then they have to. So you realize, like, we missed a chunk of this movie, which is like these people living in the world of men. And then they come to this place and they have this reverence for him. So he basically says, like, he says to them, it helps restore inner peace. Let him finish. Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, I guess we're going to let him finish carving this. And then it goes through the night and they're sitting watching. They're falling asleep. There's a part where the one cop actually holds the candle up to help him keep cutting.
Yeah.
And then when the boy finishes, he collapses in sleep. And I love that the next morning, the monk is making the paints and they're like commenting on, like, oh yeah, they use this seashell to make white. And then the monk starts painting and we realize actually they're all painting, all three of them. I love that they are these modern people, but there is this kind of reverence for this place, this person.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm watching this wondering, like, well, what is the monk, what is the master's, like, game here? What is he up to? Is he trying to convince them not to take this person, that he has already been through this redemption? And then when they finish, he wakes him up and says, okay, now it's time to go. And there's this sense of, like, oh, this is not about freedom from consequences of things that you have done. You're going to pay for these things, but you're going to do this first. And, like, that was really powerful. There's also something very cathartic about watching the monks sweep away all of the, like, scraps from the carving and sort of uncovering the letters. I loved that moment too.
I mean, it reminds me, and I don't want to make false parallels here, Sam, but it does remind me of, you know, like in the Old Testament, when David sins, he's forgiven, but there's also consequences. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the child he has with Bathsheba dies, even though David has been forgiven. So there's a sense in which I think this there's a similarity with playing out here, that the young man has to go through this kind of spiritual cleansing, you know, because the point of the sutra is to gain peace and deal with the anger in his heart. But he still has to go face the punishment of the world for what he's done. So to me, that's a very profound way of looking at it. It's like, it's not a, it's to repent is not a get out of jail free free card necessarily. There's still a consequence you need to bear. But the more important consequence, the one the monk is worried about, is what's wrong, what's happened to your heart. And so, of course, you learn when he comes back that he actually has achieved a kind of transformation that is not the same as simply being punished or paying for your crime.
Right, because there is this sense that winter cannot happen without this happening.
Right.
This is the part where that matters. We also get two great moments with the boat here, and the one that I love is the, you know, again, we're saying the master is saying, okay, get up, it's time to go. And then you see them trying to ride off with him, and the cat goes with them. And the guy rowing the boat says, it won't go forward. And you see the master put up his hand, and all of a sudden he can now row. It's like he is going to pay for his punishment, but he is not going to do it until the time is right. And there is this sense of like, okay, now you can go. And then when they get out, and I love this moment where the movie does not ever address, like, well, how do they get back and forth if one of the boat's over there? And there's the characters don't say it, but they stop and get out of the boat and they start looking around and looking back at the island. Is like, wait a minute. And then all of a sudden the boat just starts to flow back. And it's like, oh, that's right. It's
He can do
this
that.
Is how the world. Yes. So then, and then we get the master suicide. So he, you know, does the thing that his student does, right shut. Now he covers his ears too. The student doesn't cover his ears. I don't know if there's meaning to that, but I clocked that. What do you think the meaning of the master committing suicide is at this point?
Well, I don't know enough about Buddhism to preface that to say, Sam, but I am assuming that for whatever reason, he has reached the end of his particular cycle. I can say this. We think of suicide as an act of despair, or we think of suicide as an act of escape. I read it as an act of conclusion. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how he knows what the right time is, but that's the way I see it, that he's become detached enough from the world that he no longer needs to be in the world. That's one interpretation.
Yeah, no, I the same way. I mean, I wrote down he knows his work is done, like he has completed something, and in the way he prepares for it is so interesting. He lays out his coat and his shoes and the prayer drum, and you know, lays that out before the Buddha, and then it's not at all funny. You watch him prepare this, and you're like, is he going to do what I think he's going to do?
Yeah.
And then you watch it happen, and you're like, oh, okay, this he just, you know, set himself aflame and, you know, and dies in that boat. And that is, and then we see the snake seemingly come from the boat or from under the boat, go through the water onto the deck into the house. And again, snake is a symbol of death and rebirth. And there is this sense of like, if this is cyclical, this is part of that cycle. The snake is fulfilling its function in that cycle. And the snake is also serving as a guardian of that place, which is the other thing that snakes are.
It also sets up, in terms of the narrative, it sets up the pupil to now become the master.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the master has to be gone in order for him to then take the master's place. So there's that cycle as well. The sense that, I mean, it's not a literal rebirth of the master in the disciple, but that's sort of an implication that he's come to replace him.
Yes, the acknowledgement of that this he is now ready. This, because the student is ready, the master can move on. So then in winter, the man returns. Clearly, years have passed. It's unclear how old he is, and this is where it's the director playing.
You know, most of the commentaries I've read seem to assume somewhat arbitrarily, maybe, but they think it's like 10-year intervals.
Mm-hmm. That feels about right. Yeah. So we see the lake frozen. The house is in disrepair. He opens the door, but the coat, the shoes, the drum, and the snake is laying there too, as if this, I mean, literally this has been waiting for him for a decade to come here. This is his natural next step is to come here. We see him go to the boat, which this is the baffling part, is like 10 years later, that boat is still in the same spot. Like that part. Again, I don't worry about it, but it's like, I don't think that's how things work. But
And 10 years later, there's a snake in the middle of winter in the clothes. I mean, we can't worry too much about
that. Yep. But he goes and I think It's, I think he's digging out the teeth of his master. Is
Yeah,
that
it's the teeth, and also evidently there are something called Syrah, I don't know, or Sarira, which are these small crystals that are sometimes found among the cremated remains of monks and regarded as sacred relics.
Okay.
So that could be the other thing it's referred to.
So all that is to say the boat has now become not only where the master dies, it is also his reliquary to a certain degree, right? So it becomes this sacred site for him. He goes back to the waterfall, the little lake place where all the other events had happened, and here's where he carves out the ice head of Buddha, and he takes those the teeth and the crystals and puts them in the third eye of the Buddha. And what I love about the ice carving is that it reminds me of, there's a scene much earlier where you see the master writing on a rock in water, and like the water is erasing as he's writing it. So it is this sense of like creating this work of art, but it's all temporary, right? This is not a thing to last. This is a thing to exist for the time that it exists. And then this is where we see him like pull out this book of like, and it's like martial art forms, and we see him start to practice this. Okay, the fourth noble truth is basically the discipline of the Eightfold Path can lead to the end of desire and suffering. So it's like now we're seeing him practice discipline and practice these things which lead to that. So like this perfectly follows those if you want it to. Mm-hmm. And again, I did all my notes and then I read this. The last thing I read was those, and I'm just like, oh, it's so clear what this is when I see it through that lens.
Yeah.
And then is where we see the mother come with the baby again, that arresting image of the mother with the scarf over her face.
Mm-hmm.
There's this heartbreaking scene of her with the baby, and she uncovers her face to the baby.
Yeah.
We don't see it. We see her crying through the scarf in the same way we saw the master crying through the pieces of paper on his face when he dies. It's an echo of that. She tries to flee or leave at night, right? She's fleeing, right? She's leaving the baby, and she falls through the ice, and we get the next morning the baby crawls out onto the ice. So the monk goes to get the baby, and he looks and he sees the shoe in the hole, and then he sees the body under the ice, so he fishes her out. And that's where he uncovers her face. We don't get to see who that is, but he gets to see who that is.
And he has, and he bears a certain responsibility. That's the same hole that he chopped so he could do his morning ablutions.
Mm-hmm.
That's the hole that she falls in. So I think that adds to his sense of guilt and leads to his penitential trek up the mountain.
Yeah. So it concludes with him opening a cupboard and taking out a bronze Buddha, which is the Buddha to come. So I did a little bit of reading about that just to have this sense of like, that's the last Buddha of this cycle, that apparently we are currently living in. So he takes that bronze Buddha, and then he ties a grindstone. Exactly mirroring what he did to the fish and the snake and the frog, and he climbs a mountain. This made me think of like the mission, like climbing the waterfall and the mission, right? This great religious acts of climbing impossible things. There's a Sisyphus like nature to this almost. Like there's a point where he drops the Buddha and has to climb back down to get it, and goes up and then sets it up sort of so it's overlooking where he's going to spend the rest of his life, where he's going to raise this child.
Right.
And then we get to the Ann Spring. And we realize this is going to echo spring. We see the boy playing with, in his mind, playing with a turtle, but like, you know, basically knocking on its shell and giggling in the same way the boy giggles at the beginning. And you realize this is all cyclical. He has come to this sense of peace and detachment in these things. But just because he has, his responsibility now is to think about the life of this person that he is now charged with, but we're also seeing that child relive his, you know, versions of his experience. And again, the scene cut out here is that child going to the shore and stuffing rocks into the mouths of a frog, a snake, and a fish.
Yeah.
So there is this sense that like, just because he has reached this point is not the end of cruelty and humanity and these types of things, which led me to think like, so the master throughout this movie, like what were the first four chapters of his life? Like what are the, what is his version of this? Because You know, it causes you to say, well, he was not always this holy man. He too had to overcome these things. And it's, I don't know. I love this movie. So my question for you is ultimately, what do you think of this movie? Is this optimistic? Is it pessimistic? Is it hopeful? Is it bleak? Is it redeeming? Is it empty? What is this movie?
Well, I think if you think about this movie from the perspective of both kind of the Buddhist worldview that it embodies, but also, I mean, I hate to use the dreaded word universal, but there's kind of universal quality to it. I guess I would call it realistic. I guess I would say this is a movie that tells you about how human life works, and it captures that tension between, you know, within whatever tradition we embrace, whether it's a religious tradition or a secular tradition, we think we can learn by precept. Like, as you've been pointing out, Sam, the Four Noble Truths. But it seems like nobody can learn any of those noble truths without experience.
Exactly.
So we go on teaching each other. We teach our children. We try to teach ourselves. And yet, when you really boil it down, for whatever reason, we've got to go through the experience. And so then those truths become a way of maybe not helping us avoid the experience, but helping us make sense of the experience. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think ultimately it's hopeful, but it's realistic. It's hopeful because of where the original boy ends up as the older monk. But at the same time, it's realistic because we see the cycle happening in with the younger boy. And I don't find that depressing. Like I said, I just find it an accurate view of what it means to be a human being and how you deal with what it means to be a human being.
Well, one of the things that it makes me think about is when we watch the monk watch the boy torture the animals in the first spring. I think about the look on his face now and thinking like, oh, I know, like he knows the story. That's, he's already seen the movie we've watched because he's lived it.
Yeah.
And he's like, and there must be a kind of struggle to not want to halt this person because you know they need to go through it, but also the pain of knowing, I know where, like when he says this lead, like the desire to possess leads to murder, he's like, he actually knows that. And he's like, I know where this is headed, and there's kind of nothing I can do for you to stop this other than tell you the thing, but that doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, he knows. Even if he were to step in and keep the boy from doing each of those acts, that's not gonna enable the boy to come to grips with what it really means to be a human being and how he's gonna have to deal with his impulses.
Yeah, yeah. Barrett knocked it out of the park. I love this movie. What do you have anything else you want to talk about?
Well, I just wanted to say that one of the critics, one of the reviewers I read, made a connection between this film and Ozu.
Saying that
the way that each shot is set up, that it communicates so much cinematically, back to the idea of it communicates through the medium of film in a unique way. So, mm-hmm.
And I will say, I think we scratch the surface of symbols you could talk about in this movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it's all over the place. What do you have for us for next week?
Well, I'm going to continue on this theme of spirituality and the Eastern tradition, and go back to the year 1999, which is a good year, and watch Jim Jarmusch's Ghost Dog, which is the subtitle is The Way of the Samurai, and this is a film which is fairly newly available on the Criterion Channel with a wealth of extras. So it's very different from this film, very different. But I think we'll see some similarities as well.
And this is Forrest Whitaker, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. This is a movie I've heard of. I remember in 1999 hearing that title and thinking, what is this movie? And I've never seen it. But I've definitely heard people praise this movie. I've never seen a Jim Jarmusch movie. So I'm excited for everything here. Barrett, thank you so much for recommending this film. I mean, honestly, this is such a winner. If you haven't seen this, needless to the conversation, go watch this movie. It's definitely a powerful, worthwhile thing. So thank you for recommending this. Thank you for having this conversation. That is all the time that we have, but we will be back next week to talk about Ghost Dog in the Video Store.